This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Lomami National Park. The new Lomami National Park in Eastern Congo is a unique and exciting project driven by the efforts of U.S. scientists John and Therese Hart and their Congolese colleagues in a region known as TL2, after the initials of the three rivers that run through it. While many parks and preserves in poor countries are established by decree, they and the people who live in Eastern Congo are doing something different by making the local people part of the process. They're negotiating to set aside a large tract of forest for a new national park. You can hear more about this project on Tuesday, March 5th at 8 p.m. at the Waypost in Portland. I spoke with Roger in February 2013.
Congo was the first country in Africa to be granted independence from its colonial masters, and that happened in 1965. And the first independent, free, independent president of Congo was Patrice Lumumba, who was a more or less a nationalist politician who said some pretty critical things about the Belgians as they were leaving, which made a lot of people, specifically people who had a lot of monetary interest in the country, very unhappy. And to make a long story short, the U.S. and Belgian interests got very closely involved in Congo and essentially had Patrice Lumumba assassinated and installed in his place his secretary, Mobutu, Joseph Désiré Mobutu, as president. And he ruled the country for the next 30 years. And he ruled it with a similar sort of iron fist, but with a particularly kind of venal authority that ended up destroying a lot of the infrastructure and that the Belgians had built in the country and setting the stage for the sort of enormous corruption that exists there right now. The aftermath of the war was a really largely brutalized society that had seen a lot of mass killing, a lot of small rebel armies coming together to sort of take whatever they could from whoever they could in whatever context, because there was this, the sudden massive increase in the amount of small arms, available for people to use to do whatever they wanted. The people who I was working with in Congo, John and Therese Hart, who are these two American field biologists who've been in Congo for 50 years now. They went there in the 60s as Peace Corps volunteers and have eventually not really left for any length of time since. So they've been there throughout all of the upheavals. They've been there for the whole sort of life of the Congo, essentially. They've worked in a lot of different areas in the Congo, but mainly in the northeast, where they worked to develop this wildlife refuge with the Wildlife Conservation Service, which is a large international conservation organization. And they separated from them in about 2007 and went on to work on this project that I volunteered with, which was a project to set up this new national park in this comparatively unscathed area of forest that is in the east of the country, but a little bit further west than where they were working previously. The really interesting thing about this park and the project of this park is that it's the first time that anybody in Congo has tried to set up a national park and incorporate the people who live in and near it in the running of it and in the development of it, and to make it seem like a good idea and something that people would want to be a part of and to live near. All of the other parks in the Congo were decreed by Mobutu in 69 as a sort of executive fiat. He said, all of these areas that I've drawn the map here are now parks, and if you happen to be living in one of these parks, you need to leave immediately, and if you're not gone in 1 month, the soldiers of my army are going to come into the park and burn your village. So that's been the only experience that the people of Congo have of the establishment of parks, and this effort is polar opposite of that, where it's people trying to say, this park is a good idea. It means that the animals are going to be preserved, but it also means that you are going to be able to have a certain degree of employment relative to this thing, because you're going to be, not everybody, but there's opportunities for people to learn how to do certain elements of scientific research, learning how to use a GPS, learning how to cut transects, learning how to monitor animal populations and do observations and that sort of thing. And in addition to that, it's trying to create in people's minds that the forest is, in addition to being a source of your daily livelihood, it also needs to have a certain stewardship related to it, because a lot of people's relationships to the forest has been really kind of skewed by the last 10 years of total exploitation. Trying to reinforce the idea that the forest is there to provide you what you need, but it also needs to be maintained and to have certain standards held to it so that it doesn't totally degrade and become just a wasteland.
We're talking to Roger Pete. He was just in the Congo for 3 months. Before you left, you got involved with this art project.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out some way in which I could incorporate art in my participation in their project. And one thing that they had that I had seen while following their blog was that they had this printout that they would give to people in the villages around the park that was what things are totally protected and what things are not totally protected. Unless somebody's holding it out to you in front of you, nobody's going to see the information that's on it. So I thought that I could come up with a better idea, and that idea ended up being a bandana, which was printed with an image that I drew of all of these animals that are in the park, along with the name of the park. I printed it in brightly colored ink on brightly colored bandanas, and I made about 400 of them, and I took those with me when I went. The thing about a bandana is that you can wear it, you can do other things with it, you can carry something in it, you could diaper your child with it, I suppose, in an emergency, and then you can like hang it on your washing line. And anybody who walks past is going to be like, what's that? Oh, well, this is a bandana that has all the pictures of the animals that are protected in the park. Oh, well, that's very interesting. It's going to be present in public life in a way that just a handout isn't going to be. I left the huts in Kisangani, and I went upstream just with the field team. So I was the only foreigner anywhere around, and I was the only foreigner in the camp at Obenge for the 2 months that I was there. The Hearts came through once on a circuit visiting all the other camps, because they have about 5 or 6 camps around the borders of the proposed park where they have people doing scientific work in the forest, monitoring animal populations and that sort of thing. So they periodically come through and visit just to make sure that everything is going smoothly, that there aren't problems, either infrastructure problems or staffing problems, and they just come through to check. But most of the time, they're doing their own work of processing all of the scientific information that they're taking in from all these camps and the people who work at them, and also doing the outreach of community conservation and trying to present the park as an idea to the people and the chiefs of the various villages. The political work was really the most fascinating aspect of my time there, because it involved so much wrangling between the people who were promoting the idea of the park and the people who in the village were not interested in the idea of the park. And the village that I was in, Obenge, is slated for relocation outside of the boundaries of the park. It's the only village that is actually located inside that boundary. And it's right in the middle of this enormous trackless part of the forest. And it serves as a waypoint for poachers and commercial hunters to arrive at, resupply, and then head out further into the forest. If it were to be moved outside of the park, that would be much difficult for people who are trying to exploit the forest commercially. So that has been agreed to by the elders and the chief of Obenge. And there was a large meeting of all of the authorities of various levels in the region at Obenge, at which that was agreed to. And the outcome of that meeting was that there would be a monument built to that meeting to sort of commemorate that agreement, that historic agreement. So we showed up in our big dugout canoe with the field team and the supplies, and we had brought with us a bunch of bricks from some crumbling Belgian era structure in Opala and 3 sacks of cement. And we went into town to present these to the chiefs and say, look, we've brought the materials to build this monument. And her response was pretty contemptuous, saying, why are you bringing materials to build a monument? We need to see something more concrete from you that actually benefits us. You've promised us this. You've promised us houses with new roofs. You've promised us a better spring. You've promised us better animal husbandry techniques. We haven't seen anything that's worked out. We've seen a lot of things that you've tried to do that haven't worked. What need do we have of a monument? This is useless. Take your bricks and your cement and go back to your camp. We're not interested. So that threw the project, definitely for a loop, because it became obvious that she was using that as a way of saying, I need something concrete that I can show to the people of this village that implies that you can follow through on promises that you make in terms of providing something that people here can actually benefit from. So that was back to the proverbial drawing board. What happened then was that one of the park guards, the lieutenant of the four park guards who were stationed at Ubenge, and these are four armed men who were trained by the army and sent out to these areas by the National Conservation Organization, which is a branch of the Ministry of Environment, but it's more or less in charge of staffing the park areas. He came up with the idea of building a tomb, but building a tomb for one of the park guards who had died earlier that year of a mysterious illness. Nobody knows what he died of. He just got really sick and died within 2 days and was buried in the cemetery at Ubenge. And he said, well, if we do that, if we build the tomb to the park guard, she can't say no because it's our guard and we can do whatever we want to his tomb. And that will be a thing that's in the public cemetery in the village that everybody will be able to see on a daily basis. So that was proposed to her, and she said yes. So the upshot of that was we went and we had this big ceremony in the graveyard where we cleared away the old marking of the guard's tomb and laid a foundation for a new one. A lot of people in the village came out, and it was a big party, and there was a lot of drinking of manioc whiskey and eating of goat and dancing, and everybody was picking up the various eminences that were there and lifting them up in their chair and dancing around with them. And Mama Chief, which is what people call her there, was lifted up and danced around. And the lieutenant was lifted up and danced around. And I was lifted up and danced around. And it was a great time. And it was a really fun experience. And we got the foundation laid for this tomb. And we came back over the next, like a week later after it had set, and with the preacher from the village Protestant church, who happens to be a mason, we made this stepped ziggurat structure out of the bricks and used the cement to hold it together and then to cover it in cement. And then I decorated it with some flourishes and various elements that I'd picked up. Like I inscribed a vine into the surface of the tomb and wrote his name and the name of the park that he had worked, and the name of the agency that he worked for, and wrote in French, in service to nature. So it turned out to be this very nice-looking, very pleasant structure, and it ended up being this object of a more or less high-quality construction that showed that the project could actually fulfill a useful task. I mean, it's not as useful as refurbishing the spring or providing, you know, better animal husbandry techniques, but it is a small step in the right direction.
You are listening to an interview with Roger Peet, Portland artist and printmaker, about his experiences last year in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Every Sunday that I was in the village and not in the forest, I went to the Protestant church and recorded the singing that was there. It's just all just drums and singing, and it's a bunch of different choirs. There was a young women's choir of about 8-year-olds, a young women's choir of about 16 to 18-year-olds, and then an older women's choir of 40 to 50-year-olds or 60-year-olds. And then there was a men's choir. And it's just this amazing music that's all written by people in Ubenge or in villages near Ubenge, and is totally amazingly powerful. Just raw drums, all played by 13-year-old or 15-year-old boys, and these amazing multi-part choral explosions of music that are totally astonishing. One thing that happened, the Obenge soccer team had gone to play an away game in a village nearby. And while they were in that village, they had run into Colonel Toms, who had asked them what they had to say about all the rumors he had been hearing that the park guards in Obenge were hassling the population, stealing from the population, and raping the women. And luckily there was somebody with the soccer team who was more or less on the side of the park who was able to say, no, that's not true. That's not happening at all. The park guards are behaving themselves, and they're just providing security for the people who are doing that scientific work. And Colonel Tom says, huh, that's very interesting. Well, maybe I should come and visit Obenge and sort that out. And the soccer team came back and reported this to the people who work for the park project, who said, well, he's not going to come here. There's four armed agents of the state here. He's not going to come. He knows he's guilty. He knows he's an escaped prisoner. He's not going to show up. But lo and behold, 2 weeks later, I was sitting down by the river doing some drawing or working on a block print or something, and I saw a canoe go by with four people in it that I didn't recognize, and I thought, that's odd. I wonder who they are. And then a couple of minutes later, another canoe came by that was much closer into the bank, and I noticed that the people in that canoe had guns. And I waved at them, and the man in the front, who had an enormous beard, looked at me and kind of sneered and gave a dismissive gesture and said, "Pah!" And I thought, maybe that's Colonel Toms. And lo and behold, suddenly the camp was all aflutter with activity, and somebody came running down the hill and said, "Oh, Mr. Roger, the poachers are here." So I went up the hill, and everybody was sort of a little bit wide-eyed and tense, and I asked, well, so the poachers are here, how's everything going? And they're like, well, Maurice and Pablo and the lieutenant have gone into town to talk to him. And Maurice and Pablo, who are the two sort of chief field workers, and the lieutenant, who's the head of the park guards, spent a long time in the village talking to Colonel Toms, and that evening they came back and reported on what they'd been talking to him about. And what transpired was that Colonel Toms had showed up in the village in order to have a parley with the people involved in the park, specifically because of all of the rumor that he had been hearing about what the park guards had been doing, and presumably, and also about what people had been saying to the park about him, because the park had received a lot of threats, written threats from Colonel Toms that had no basis. Like, they would receive a letter that said, "Hello, people of the park, I'm coming to burn your village. I'm coming to burn your park encampment and kill you all on Tuesday if you don't leave, so you should probably leave now." Tuesday would come and go, and nothing would happen, so people would realize, well, that letter wasn't written by Colonel Toms. And so Colonel Toms showed up to try and make some sort of understanding, try to come to some sort of agreement between his team and our team. And as what he, essentially what he was saying was, look, I'm an armed man with a bunch of other armed men. You are armed men, and we're both in the same forest. And what I would prefer is that we met each other in the forest, that we left each other alone. Now, I've changed my behavior. I don't harass the population anymore. I'm not stealing from people. I'm not raping people. I'm not exploiting people in the way that I used to, because I spent a year in prison, and I don't want to go back. I don't want to rock the boat too much. But one thing I am going to continue to do is to poach elephants, because that's all I know how to do. So I'm going to be over here in this part of the forest poaching elephants. I'm not going to come into your scientific study area, and I'm going to leave you alone, and I want you to do the same to me. And essentially that was what he came to say, and the people who work at the park couldn't really do anything but say, okay, that sounds like a fair deal. We're not too excited about the poaching elephants part, but it's great that you've stopped harassing the population and that you're not going to be harassing the population any further. And, Colonel Tom said, if it's going to happen, then I've got to come to grips with it. And I feel like my star is falling, and I need to provide for my family and my children, so I'm not going to stand in your way. So it was kind of a breakthrough to a large extent, but it left open this interesting phenomenon where as soon as he left, all of the field workers and the guys who worked for the park project started thinking up machinations of how they could possibly entrap Colonel Toms and get him arrested again. Well, he visited us, you know, we should say that we want to go and visit him, and we'll go and visit him, and we'll get a GPS fix on where his camp is, and then we can tell the army to come in and do a pincer movement and get him. And, you know, everybody was coming up with all sorts of plans and ideas of that sort of thing, and all of which was well and good until people considered the fact that he'd gone to prison once already, and that he'd escaped from prison. And you don't escape from prison in Congo purely by benefit of your own cunning. You escape because you slip somebody some money, or somebody has your interests in mind and engineers a possibility for you to escape. Pays a guard to look the other way, you know, pays for somebody to open a door or to leave a door open. Like, he didn't escape from prison on his own. So any return to prison for Colonel Toms would probably entail another escape, and if it could be shown to Colonel Toms that somebody had betrayed him, then he would immediately return to summarily execute that person or persons. So it was a very difficult catch-22 situation. It was positive, but also not positive, and opened up a whole new can of worms.
You are listening to an interview with Roger Peet, Portland artist and printmaker, about his experiences last year in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Therese wrote a sort of end-of-year report talking about some of the difficulties that they've been facing in terms of the corruption at higher levels in the government that they've had to deal with. And they've had to deal with a lot of very complicated issues. I mean, for example, the nephew of the head of the National Conservation Institute was sort of deputized to be a representative of that entity for the region that the park is in, and he was found out last year to have been involved in sort of the commercial exploitation of parrots for the pet trade. And parrots are one of the animals that I drew on the bandana. They're totally protected, and they're not supposed to be hunted or traded commercially at all. And so for this, you know, that's kind of an emblematic situation for corruption in the Congo, is that people in authority who are supposed to be doing certain jobs use their authority often to exploit those positions of power to make money for themselves. And this guy who is trading parrots under the auspices of a conservation organization is a perfect example. And they, you know, the project faces a lot of opposition from people in power who want to exploit the resources that the project has because they have grant money coming in from source of potential money, and graft and extortion and just general corruption and attempts to siphon off funds from that are a constant source of pressure and difficulty for the project. And 2012, I think, was a particularly difficult year for that sort of thing. And they, you know, they persevere against enormous odds, but the degree of difficulty that they face in actually getting this park to be a reality sometimes seems insurmountable in light of what forces are arrayed against it. Because it goes all the way to the highest levels of government, people are always asking, what's in it for me? And the priority isn't. The priority of almost everybody who was involved in the Congolese government in this park project, the priority is generally, what's in it for me? Not necessarily, how can we best make this happen to benefit the people who live in the area and to benefit the forest and the animals and the plants that live in the forest. If people want to read what I've written about the project, you can see it online at lomamibandanas.tumblr.com. And that's a bunch of photos and writing that I've done about the project. The blog that the Hearts write is called bonoboincongo.com. And it's I don't have to spell it out. If you search for Bonobo in Congo, you'll find it. And it has an enormous amount of information about Congo and about the sort of complicated politics and the complicated politics and the general cultural milieu in which this park is being developed. And it's a fascinating document. And Therese is a great writer, and she's also a great photographer. And she balances the social aspects with the aspects of science. And for instance, in this region where I was, there was this newly described species of monkey that was discovered last year. And it's only found in the small area where this park is. And there's a lot, you know, and there's a bunch of articles on the blog about the discovery of this monkey and how it was discovered, which was as an orphaned juvenile whose parents had been shot by poachers, and then somebody had adopted this orphan monkey, and some of the park workers noticed this monkey they'd never seen before as someone's pet in a village, and they wrote to the Hearts and said, "What's this species of monkey?" And they figured out that it was a species of monkey that nobody'd described before in scientific literature. So there's a lot of stuff like that in there. There's a lot of fascinating scientific information and really interesting cultural information about a part of the world that people know very little about and that is just full of fascinating stuff. I'm going to be doing a slideshow from all of my photos from the Congo and also going to be playing some of the recordings I made in the Obenge Protestant Church, which are totally crazy. And showing some video I shot. And that's all going to be happening at the Waypost Cafe Bar on Northeast Williams on March 7th at about 8 p.m. So if anybody listening wants to come to that, you should, because it's going to be a pretty fascinating experience, I think.
More information about Roger and the Bandana Project can be found at lomamibandanas.tumblr.com. The website of Therese and John Hart, directors of the TL2 project, is bonoboincongo.com. This program will be archived on the KBOO website. You can listen again at kboo.fm. Thanks to Jackson for help editing. And for KBOO Radio, I'm Erin Yankee. Up next on KBOO is Movin' On, political, traditional, and contemporary folk music. Thanks for listening.
And we have a brief correction. As Erin Yankee noted, she announced Pete's appearance at the Waypost as Tuesday, March 5th. But as Roger Pete mentioned there at the end, it is indeed Thursday, March 7th at 8 p.m. at the Waypost, 3120 North Williams Avenue. KBOO regrets the error.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help sponsor Hope on the Slopes, a 24-hour skiing and snowboarding fundraiser to help benefit the American Cancer Society. Hope on the Slopes will start at 1 p.m. on Friday, March 1st, and continue until 1 p.m. on Saturday, March 2nd, at the Mountain Hood Ski Bowl. Hope on the Slopes is a competitive, family-friendly event that combines fun and enjoyment on the slopes with the passion to change the world. You can ski for 6 hours, 18 hours, or try the full 24 hours. Form a team with your friends, families, or coworkers. Again, Hope on the Slopes is 24 hours starting at 1 p.m. on March 1st at Mount Hood Ski Bowl. For more information, go to kboo.fm/hopeontheslopes.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Argus, presenting the Louisiana Cajun band Beau Soleil with Portland's own New Iberians, Tuesday, March 19th at the Melody Ballroom. A full Cajun dinner is available with the show by reservation when you call 503-232-2759. And the Melody Ballroom is at 615 Southeast Alder. Tickets at tickettomato.com.
Hi, this is Justin Miller, KBOO's underwriting coordinator. Every day, local businesses support KBOO through program sponsorship or underwriting. These underwriters are people like you, progressive, diverse, and supporting real radio. So when you hear an underwriter's acknowledgement, consider giving them some of your business and telling them that you heard about them on KBOO. If your business would like to reach out to the area's 55,000 most diverse and progressive listeners, you can learn how at kboo.fm/underwriting, by email to underwriting@kboo.org, or call Justin 503-231-8032. KBOO Underwriting. Your clients are listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a very few minutes right after the news headlines. I have a very special guest. Small Potatoes will be performing live in the studio. It's time now for the noon headlines.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, March 3rd. I'm Kristen Yount. United Grain locked out workers at a Vancouver, Washington terminal yesterday. The lockout comes after months of failed negotiations, which came to a head after management accused an elected union officer of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union of sabotage. Non-union workers have been unloading grain. Union represented rail workers did not cross the picket line. Non-union crews picked up the slack, operating tugboats and trains to the terminal. The National Labor Review Board in Seattle has not received a complaint as of yesterday. The lockout is considered against national labor laws. In a historic show of support, President Barack Obama's administration sent a barrage of friend of the court briefs to the Supreme Court to encourage the court to overturn the Defense of Marriage Act and reinstate California's Prop 8, which would legalize